personal minimums. Great concept, lousy training standard. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller, who is a certified flight instructor based in the Buffalo area. He puts out Over the Airwaves, the Journal for the Proficient Pilot, which is an internet publication, and that's a monthly, and we're going to talk about some of the topics that Bob has discussed in his latest edition, which is dated March 1st. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure as always, Paul.
Now, Bob, you just in the past few days took what turned out to be kind of a harrowing flight, and you used it as an example to make a couple of points you've made in somewhat abstract fashion in previous talks with us and in previous articles and Over the Airwaves. Let's talk about your article entitled The Rulebook and Personal Minimums, Hogwash, and tell us why they're hogwash.
This particular flight took place recently. It involved a trip nonstop from Panama City, Florida, up to Buffalo, New York. I was returning from a two-day a business trip that took me to Savannah, then later over to Panama City. And I use that as an example of the caution that needs to be exhibited by flight instructors and flight schools regarding absolute adherence to the FARs. They be black and white and very clear and governing in all situations.
We're not talking about cheating the rules. We're talking about the rules maybe not tight enough.
Well, the point that I'm trying to make is the rules do not govern all situations. Under most normal flight circumstances, they do. But unfortunately, a lot of the flying that we do, particularly business flying or mission-related flying that involves something other than a recreational flight on a Sunday afternoon, many of these flights involve abnormal situations where the FARs simply do not cover the circumstances at hand. In my particular flight, I was I planned a flight at 19,000 feet to overfly a low-pressure area and a lot of very, very poor weather that ranged from the Gulf Coast up through to Canada. And at high altitudes, it was not really going to be a factor. And then the only challenging part would be the descent into Buffalo through potentially icing conditions. My particular airplane is a turbocharged Cessna 210 that is certified for flight into known icing conditions. So all in all, it met the requirements of the FARs. About two-thirds of the way into the flight, I elected to test my inflatable boots just to be sure that they were operating properly prior to my descent into Buffalo, and discovered immediately that upon activation, the main vacuum pump that operates both the inflatable boots and my instruments, my gyro instruments, immediately failed at that point, rendering my aircraft no longer certifiable for flight into known icing conditions. That did not eliminate, however, the operational fact that now I had to either divert some 250 miles into headwinds to find VFR conditions, which would have challenged my remaining fuel reserves, or in effect, violate the FAR, specifically 91.9, that prohibits flight into known icing conditions in non-known ice-certified airplanes.
Well, now, let me ask you a technical point here. First of all, you've just outlined a situation where you took off in perfectly good faith. You've been weather-briefed and all that, and now you find yourself in a situation where you're forced to choose your violation. Because if you land with less than the required reserves, you're in trouble, too, on an IFR flight.
Well, technically, yes. And operationally, it was even a greater concern because, you know, the likelihood of running low or out of fuel was an untenable option.
Mm-hmm.
Descending into cold, sub-freezing clouds in a non-ice-capable airplane, that was an operational consideration that had a potentially better outcome. But as I contemplated doing this, my mind raced back to many dozens of arguments that I've had with my flight instructor, flight school colleagues who believe that the FARs are to be followed point by point in every situation, particularly as it applies to flight into known icing conditions. Now, riding high above the weather, I was not in any particular emergency situation. So, you know, my authority under the emergency authorities given to me as a pilot really was not a factor. The question is, do I now knowingly and willingly descend down into icing conditions? That was the choice that I had to make. It was the only choice that seemed reasonable at the time. Now, the next concern was one of, what do I do if I encounter ice? Well, having flown many, literally hundreds of hours in icing conditions in my known ice aircraft, I recognized that there were techniques that could be employed that would mitigate the risks of airframe icing. And having had experience and training in flight into icing conditions, that made the descent that much more or much less risky because I had an understanding of what to do if we began to build ice. The second aspect of this particular flight, prior to departure, my pre-flight briefing revealed that Buffalo at the time of my planned arrival, had a 900-foot ceiling, 900 AGL-foot ceiling, and several miles of visibility. As I made my final approach into Buffalo on that particular night, I soon discovered that the visibility had dropped to less than one quarter of a mile, and the ceiling was totally obscured in heavy snow. And I thought back to, again, many arguments or discussions I've had with my flight school and flight instructor colleagues that insist that every pilot should have a set of personal minimums, mm-hmm. particularly instrument students. Those minimums would suggest that they would never operate in ceilings below 500 feet AGL or something like that. Well, the point here was weather changes, and weather can change dramatically and without advance warning. Had I been capable of only flying to a 500-foot ceiling and now faced a 200-foot ceiling or one right at minimums, I would have been hard-pressed to successfully execute that procedure. Well, as it turned out, the weather was at minimums. I managed to keep the needle centered and landed the aircraft safely in heavy snow at the Buffalo Airport. Because I had both the experience, the proficiency, and the skills to do so. Had I been one of those pilots who set personal minimums substantially higher than published instrument minimums, I could have been in very, very serious trouble. Now, in both those instances where I had to make a decision to descend into icing clouds and shoot an approach to minimums, I again recognized the fact that adherence to the FARs and personal minimums would not have been suitable for my particular need.
Bob, we need to take a break here, but when we come back, I want to talk technically about the regulations as applied to the flight that you just described and talk more about how we reconcile personal minimums with training minimums. Why do I get the feeling we're going to get some mail this week? I'm Paul Platt. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Flagg, talking today with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves. And we're talking about a flight Bob made last week where he faced a choice of descending through clouds with de-icing equipment which was not working properly, or diverting to an airport where the conditions were better but at the risk of dipping uncomfortably deeply into his fuel reserves. Bob, now you set out on a 900-mile flight. If you do that kind of flying, it seems to me you're going to face this kind of situation a lot more frequently than a student pilot in the training environment to whom a long cross-country is described as a 150-mile flight.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole different set of circumstances. Tell us why, specifically why, personal minimums are not a good idea in this situation.
Having personal minimums in a normal situation is fine. I mean, when you're sitting on the ground and saying, you know, I'm not going to launch into a 200-foot ceiling and set that as a personal minimum, that's fine operationally under normal conditions. But that does not eliminate the need for instrument pilots to be proficient, operationally proficient, to operate in the national airspace system down to published minimums. In my situation, had I had personal minimums that suggested that I would not land in anything other than an 800 or 900-foot ceiling, and then upon arrival at Buffalo discovered that we had less than a 200-foot ceiling and a quarter-mile visibility and lacked the skills to fly an approach to minimums, I would have been hard-pressed to achieve a successful outcome.
So we should have personal minimums that guide our decision-making in terms of go, no-go. But we shouldn't let that be a limit on our training, is what you're saying.
That's exactly right. And flight instructors and flight schools that limit their training to, say, 600-foot ceilings and 4 miles of visibility, suggesting that no instrument pilot ought to be flying in conditions less than that, that's fine from an academic perspective, but that does not take into consideration the real operational fact that weather will decline unpredictably and upon short notice, so that we may be preparing students to fly comfortably into a 600-foot landing situation and then suddenly be faced with a 200-foot situation and having never flown an approach to that low weather with or without an instructor. Now, I use as my basis for this observation is the unrelenting fact that we have over 300 fatal accidents in the United States every year. Mm-hmm. Now, most of those accidents do not occur under normal flight operation conditions. Most of the fatal accidents occur as a result of an abnormal situation, whether it be an encounter with IFR conditions where you didn't expect it, either with a IFR or non-IFR rated pilot. That's number one. Number two, a flight involving airframe icing, flight involving a failed component while in flight, severe crosswinds or turbulence. These are non-normal circumstances, which, in my opinion, are not adequately being addressed in the primary flight training scenarios.
Well, now we got to talk about primary flight training as what you need to get the certificate, and then, you know, I guess you could consider it to still be primary flight training in the real sense of the term, to take refresher or additional instruction after you get your certificate. I wonder how many people are going to do this. Are you suggesting that we should raise the bar that high for the certificate itself?
Yes, I do. I do believe that. The number one fatal cause of all accidents, weather-related accidents, for example, is continued VFR flight into IFR conditions. Now, time and time and time again, I encounter pilots coming to me for a biennial flight review that have their private pilot certificate, and we go into the clouds as part of a BFR, and all of a sudden, I observe, you know, cold beads of perspiration sliding down the sides of their face, and I ask, what is the problem? They said, well, I've never been in IFR conditions before.
Mm-hmm.
The primary flight curriculum requires a minimum of 3 hours of instrument flight instruction. Well, I would venture to say that in about 95% of the cases, these are simulated IFR training conditions where a view-limiting device was used to simulate instrument conditions. Well, that's a whole other issue, but in my opinion, view-limiting devices are a cruel hoax because they in no way can simulate real IFR conditions. That's an example, Paul, where I believe the primary flight instruction curriculum or standard needs to be increased, that under unless there's unusual circumstances, and I don't really know how you control for this, but in Arizona, New Mexico, it's very difficult for flight schools to find instrument conditions. But over the vast portions of the United States, certainly here in upstate New York, we have more clouds than we have sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
To subject students to simulated conditions for their 3 hours of instrument work, again, is a fantasy. And I think it's designed only to get the student through the check ride, because in all likelihood on the check ride, he or she will be asked to put on a view-limiting device and see that they can control the airplane, keep the wings level solely by reference to the instruments. That gets the pilot through the check ride. It does not get the pilot through the real world of flying experiences. And again, all we have to do is go back and look at the high number of fatalities resulting from continued VFR flight into IMC conditions, where the pilot has less than 45 seconds to survive.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe these flight schools in places where they don't have bad weather often enough could practice with students at night.
Yeah, excellent point, Paul. Absolutely. That would be a great way to do it. Go out on a moonless night over the wide open spaces of the desert, and you have, in effect, real IFR conditions. Yeah, excellent suggestion.
Well, I don't know that we'll solve the problem of inadequate training requirements, because as we're going to talk about in the next couple of weeks, Bob, one of your other articles in this issue is about where the bar is set, the fact that it was set there 60 years ago, and the fact that we keep fighting improving the standards. So we'll talk about that another time. I'm glad you made it down, okay, and it's been great to talk to you, and we'll look for you again next Monday.
Thanks again, Paul.
You can find Bob's latest writings at overtheairwaves.com, and you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.